that's the standard model. Okay. And so the standard model, we've all heard many things about this over the past 50 years. And it's kind of interesting in a very abbreviated notation. It can fit on a t-shirt, right? So or a coffee mug or something. Probably many of us have such things. But here I've written part of what appears on this t-shirt in a slightly less abbreviated notation. But focusing on kind of the part of the standard model, the part of the Lagrangian describing the standard model of particle physics that is most of interest to this crowd. So that has to do with the leptons of the standard model. And so the leptons come in two different styles. So there's a left-handed kind. They live inside of this weak isodoublet. So there's a neutrino and a charged lepton, both left-handed. And then there's the right-handed partner of the left-handed charged lepton. And these guys differ in the with respect to how they talk to weak interactions or how they couple to the weak interactions. And so it's only the left-handed guys that know about the weak charge currents. So the W bosons here couple only to the left-handed neutrinos and charged leptons. The right-handed guys don't know anything about the charge current interactions of the electroweak sector. Then there's furthermore, the charged leptons, we see that they have masses. And so the only way, given the fact that the left-handed guys and the right-handed guys have different couplings with respect to the weak gauge interactions, the only way to give them a mass is to couple them to some other thing that knows about the weak interactions, and that's a Higgs doublet. And so that happens through a term like this. Okay, so this is the standard model, right, for the lepton sector of it, except it's a little bit more complicated. And so, it's all right. Yeah, I can just push the. Okay, so basically, the difference, or what I haven't written down before, was just the fact that the leptons come in three different flavors or three different generations. And so we can, represent that by just putting little indices here everywhere, right? So these little I's and J's, they just represent the different generations of the standard model. So one, two, three. So E1 means an electron, E2 means muon, and so on. Okay? And in particular, you can see here the gauge interactions. So the interaction with the W in particular doesn't care about the type of lepton that's involved, right? So it's diagonal in this way. And so what that means is now if we ask about how strongly does the lightest charged lepton couple to the W and how strongly does the next lightest charged lepton, the muon, couple to the W, they couple with equal strength. Okay? So that's what this ratio is meant to indicate. Okay, this works. Thanks, Ben. Okay, so all right, so up here, the gauge interactions, they don't care about which lepton you're talking about. They're universal. But there are these interactions that give masses, and those are what define the different, what name we give each of these leptons. And so in particular, it's this last line here that's responsible for the difference between the electron and the muon, in particular their masses. And they have some funny ratio that happens to be something like 200 between them. And okay, so the standard model, this has been tested over and over, and it works exceedingly well, super well. But there's these I's and J's that I've written down here, and there's three of them. We don't know why. This is a mystery. And actually, I think it's, I mean, it's been a mystery since we first discovered that I and J can run from, aren't just one. So in other words, like when the muon was discovered, Rabi was famously said to have asked who ordered that. And I think his question still holds true today. So there's no real good reason for why there are three generations. We have no idea why that is. There's a lot of puzzles in the standard model, but I think the puzzle about why there are three generations is an interesting one. And okay, so other puzzles might have to do with like, all right, so the Higgs mass is what it is, blah, blah, blah. You can tell a story about why it has to be somewhat light compared to the scale of quantum gravity if you want to talk about getting a universe that looks like ours. But I don't think, at least as far as I'm aware, there isn't any argument about why you need three generations to get a universe like ours. So it just is. And what that means is you can't resort to any kind of goofy Anthropic arguments about, oh, well, you know, we could only exist in a universe with these three generations. I don't think that that's true. I could be wrong. Maybe there are some people more clever than me, but I think this means that this problem of why there are three generations is crying out for a physics explanation that has to do with the universe that we live in and not some metaverse or something like that. So I think it's a very interesting question to ask, and it's also really, really hard to answer. So we need to figure out why that is. Yeah. Hi. Yeah, but that doesn't do anything. Yeah. Yeah, that would be nice if that phase actually, it just tells us that it's okay to imagine such theories. So God is telling us it's okay to consider, you know, CP violation in other theories or other sectors where that CP violation is useful. But the CP violation of the standard model is not useful, I guess is what I mean. It's not useful from a, you can't use it to engineer an Anthropics type argument is basically what I'm trying to say here. Yeah, maybe there's some. Yeah, it could be related to some electroweak baryogenesis arguments and stuff like that, but at least it's a bit convoluted. And I just want to say it's an interesting problem that you need, you know, there needs to be a dynamical solution to. So, in other words, we need a theory of flavor. And flavor means, you know, it's basically determined by the Yukawa couplings, or in other words, the masses of the charged leptons. They tell us what the names of the charged leptons are. Okay, so we need a theory of flavor. So we need to understand, okay, why are these charged leptons very similar to one another, but a little bit different? Okay, one way that this slight difference manifests, the similarity and the slight difference between the charged leptons manifests itself is in decays of, well, for instance, let me choose a random particle, let's say a charged pion, and ask how it decays. So, as all of you know, I'm sure, it can decay into either an electron or a muon. And it turns out, because of this chiral structure of the weak interaction, so the weak gauge bosons, the charged weak gauge bosons, the Ws, know only about left-handed leptons or right-handed anti-leptons. That means that when you write down the amplitude, the quantum mechanical amplitude for this decay, it involves a right-handed at this vertex here between the W and the charged lepton. It involves a right-handed positively charged lepton if we're thinking about decays of a pi plus. And so, but if you know, go and ask about the conservation of angular momentum, knowing that the pion is a spin zero boson, that requires a spin flip of this charged lepton to be able to conserve angular momentum. Okay, so then you have to flip this guy's spin, and this spin flips kind of have to do with the mass of a particle. Basically, because if something is massless, then you know you can't run and get you know it's moving and it's massless. It's moving at the speed of light. You can't get into a frame that's moving faster than that particle, and so you can't flip the spin if the thing doesn't have any mass. So this is a convoluted way of saying you need a mass insertion here to conserve angular momentum. And that's at the amplitude level, and then it's quantum mechanics, so you square amplitudes to get rates. So that means that the rate is proportional to the square of the lepton mass in the final state. And so that means that pions want to decay to muons a lot more than they want to decay to electrons by a factor of something like 10,000. And this is tested at the 0.1% level locally. You guys should do a lot better than that. And it's a situation where the prediction is kind of maybe a little bit ahead now of the experiment. And so this is an interesting opportunity to look for deviations. So this is predicted in the standard model at that sort of a level. How can it vary? So, you know, if let's, we know that for various reasons that the standard model is not complete. And so seeing something that differs from this number here in the ratio of this decay rate to that decay rate would tell us that the standard model is violated. How could that be? Well, one simple thing that you could imagine is the charged leptons mixing with some heavy state, okay, that doesn't have the exact same quantum numbers that they have. And this could be actually an explanation of flavor. So you have to have some understanding of why these charged leptons, which obey the same or have the same gauge interactions, why they are different from one another. And that difference could come about from some heavy state that mixes with each of them a little bit differently. And that would give rise to different masses for each of these states. And if that's the case, so I've illustrated that with some, you know, mixing angle that relates the light charge leptons to the mass eigenstates, to the gauge eigenstates, which know about this coupling to the W. That gets shifted. This ratio is no longer unity. And it's shifted by the cosine of each of these mixing angles. Okay, and so we know that these mixing angles are probably not big. That would be hard to accommodate. And so if they're small, then that means that you get a shift of this ratio that's proportional to the difference in these mixing angles squared. And so that means that testing this at the 0.01% level corresponds to testing mixing angles at the 1% level. And this is something that could be motivated by an actual attempt at understanding the flavor puzzle of the standard model. Okay, so that's one simple thing that you could imagine probing with this kind of, by, you know, studying these the ratio of these couplings, which is manifest in the ratio of the pion branching ratios. Other new physics, of course, is, you know, could be accessed in this kind of a decay. And you know, a couple of simple things involve heavy new physics at sort of the weak scale. So the scale of, you know, say the Higgs boson or maybe even heavier. So maybe you have a new gauge boson, kind of very similar to the W that we know about, but it, instead of talking to left-handed leptons, it talks to right-handed leptons. If that's the case, then you need another a partner, a right-handed partner of the charged leptons that's also neutral. So this thing is like a neutrino, but it's right-handed. So this is some kind of a sterile neutrino. I'll talk a little bit more about these in a bit. But what's interesting is that this thing could have a very different mass. We don't know what it is. And actually, it probably would have to be somewhat massive. And if that's the case, then this spin flip that I was talking about, this helicity flip, that involves a mass insertion in the amplitude, could be made up on the neutrino line, this right-handed neutrino line. And so you might not suffer in this case from a large suppression of the electron branching ratio with respect to the muon branching ratio through this exchange of a heavy right-handed W. And if that's the case, then you could get a pretty significant shift of this ratio of the branching ratios. Okay, that's one possibility. Another possibility is, you know, if there's some objects that have, you can maybe call them leptoquarks that have, they couple to both quarks and leptons, so they're leptoquarks. They carry baryon number and lepton number. And if these things exist, they could also be kind of related to the puzzle of flavors, so that they, you know, pick out one flavor or another, the electron or the muon, and couple to the, you know, one of them preferentially with respect to the other. And if these things exist, then they can modify this decay rate as well. And essentially, you know, there's an interesting review recently by a lot of people that you know very well, where they kind of, you know, come up with a laundry list of these sorts of things that could be tested in pion decay. And essentially, if the scale of these of this new physics is something like lambda, so that's some new energy scale, at say the weak scale or above, the shifts in this ratio of branching ratios are, you know, related to the ratio, how large that scale is with respect to the weak scale, which governs the charge pion decay. So that is, you know, in other words, the Fermi constant. And so the shifts of this R ratio here are kind of, you know, parametrically given by an expression that looks like this, up to factors of a few. And so, you know, this makes it clear that if you can test this at the kind of 0.1% or better level, that you're actually also testing new physics that gives rise to these operators at the several TeV scale. So this is interesting. It's very competitive with LHC, for instance. And yes. Oh, no, I'm done now.
Can we use a mic? Because otherwise, you know, I'm not going to.
Is ceiling lights on?
The ceiling lights on.
Oh, should be okay. Yeah.
So on the left-hand one, the WR presumably is going to be fairly heavy.
Yes.
And so that's going to be suppressed. You're going to need a lot of mixing to show effect. So the NR is going to need to be fairly massive.
Yes.
And then the two-body decay is going to have that lepton having a substantially different energy than it would if you're going through.
Yes, so it might not just shift the branching ratio, but you might look for bumps in a different place if this thing is heavy enough that it's also produced. Tiny little bumps, yes.
Yeah.
So we'll talk a little bit more about that in a second.
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, you're right. Okay, so all right, so that kind of is a nice segue into the next slide, which has to do a little bit more about objects like this thing here, this right-handed neutrino. So other, you know, new physics that we know, well, other new physics that addresses problems that we know exist in the Standard Model involves right-handed or sterile neutrinos. And these are motivated by the fact that neutrino oscillation experiments tell us that the neutrinos have small but non-zero masses. And so we, whereas in the Standard Model, their masses are, you know, technically speaking, zero. And so if we want to accommodate non-zero masses for the neutrinos, we have to introduce new physics. Maybe the simplest thing to do is to just do what we did for all the other fermions of the Standard Model, the leptons and the quarks, and give the left-handed neutrinos a right-handed partner. Okay, so I've written that down as an NR here. And so that guy also has a kinetic term. It's a singlet. It knows nothing about the gauge interaction. So this kinetic term here doesn't have any, you know, Ws or Zs or anything like that. And then it has a Yukawa coupling. So that involves the Higgs and then this lepton doublet, the left-handed lepton doublet. And then now we just have this partner for the neutrinos. Okay, so the same thing that we've done for all of the other fermions in the Standard Model. But there's a law that you cannot break, and that is when you're writing down, you know, you're playing Lagrangian Sudoku or whatever, you have to write down everything that you're allowed to write down by gauge invariance. So anything that doesn't break any symmetries associated with gauge transformations in the Standard Model, you have to write down. And in particular, the one term that you need to write down then, once you've introduced this partner for the right-handed neutrino or for the neutrinos, this right-handed neutrino, sterile neutrino, you have to write down a Majorana mass for it. Okay, you're not allowed to not do that. There's no law that tells you you can't, so you have to. That is the law. So you do that, okay? Now you have the same Lagrangian, and then electroweak symmetry is broken. So that means the Higgs field here gets a VeV. And what that does is it mixes this right-handed neutrino with the left-handed neutrino. There's just, so this is the mass term, this is just like the mass terms for all of the other fermions in the standard model. But unlike the, all the other fermions in the standard model, this partner has a Majorana mass of its own. So this is a Majorana type mass. And what that does is, you know, whenever you see a mass matrix or a mass terms in a Lagrangian like this, you have to diagonalize them. That's just, that's what you do. Anytime in quantum mechanics you see a Hamiltonian, you diagonalize it. So, so you do that. And then what you learn is that you get two separate states. Okay, so typically you get a light state that is mostly the left-handed active neutrino of the standard model. This thing, this part, knows about the weak interactions. And then you get a small admixture with a mixing angle people often write as U. A small admixture of this sterile part. So that's the light state. Then there's two, you know, spin components here. So you have some fermion, it has spin up, spin down. That's the light state. Then you have a heavier state that's mostly this sterile guy, and then a little bit of active guy. Okay, so the orthogonal linear combination. And it also, it's a fermion, it has two spin states. So this is in contrast to the case with all the fermions we know about in the standard model, where you have a degenerate pair of fermion and antifermion. So you have, you know, electron and positron. So two pairs, so there's kind of 4 degrees of freedom, and they're all degenerate, and that's because of CPT invariance, because the electron has a charge. In the case of the neutrino, it doesn't have that charge anymore, so this degeneracy is no longer in play. And so in general, these four states can become two that are not degenerate with one another. So that's just, you know, anytime you're talking about a neutral fermion, that's kind of the most general situation that you can imagine. Is two pairs of non-degenerate fermions, just like this. Okay, so yeah, I should have mentioned, I've been kind of calling this a right-handed neutrino. I mean, people do that, it's sterile, it doesn't have any gauge interactions. These days, sometimes people talk about these things using the name heavy neutral leptons, so these are kind of all the same thing in some sense. So just for your edification, all right, this is, well, I didn't want to go that quickly. All right, so you get a preview. Okay. All right, so here's one kind of thing I've been sweeping under the rug, which is the this scale here, this Majorana mass scale is kind of, there's nothing that tells us what that scale is, okay? And so, when I see things like this, and actually maybe even Anne was talking about sterile neutrinos, and I don't remember, but I do remember what my old boss, Anne, said some years ago to me about, you know, we're good theorists, we're kind of good at writing down Lagrangians, what they should look like writing down all the pieces, how they fit together, stuff like that, you know, what fields should appear, blah, blah, blah. That we're, you know, pretty good at, I guess. But what we're not good at is guessing what the values of those things that appear in the Lagrangian are. Okay, so for instance, you know, if you look at like people thinking about neutrino oscillations in the 90s or something, it's often assumed that the neutrino mixing matrix is kind of similar to the quark mixing matrix, but it turns out no. So that, you know, sometimes so we have to resort to other, well, we're not good at guessing, basically. So, in other words, I want to, you know, as a theorist here talking to experimentalists, I want to tell you to take us seriously, but not too seriously. So, in particular, I want to just mention that this, you know, we don't know what that parameter is, and so in principle, it could be kind of any number, and we should really constrain what that is and look for it anywhere we can. Okay, so hopefully, all right, good. This is only one slide ahead. So, okay, if these right-handed sterile neutrinos exist, how might we look for them? This was kind of alluded to earlier with the prescient question, but the way this shows up and modifies things is that, okay, we have pi end decay again. And then occasionally we have a very small mixing. So, you know, this is a small mixing that allows for this pi end decay to produce a, produces the active neutrino, which is an admixture of light and heavy neutrinos. And sometimes the heavy neutrino is light enough that it's also produced in the decay. Sometimes it's too heavy for that to happen, and so it doesn't get produced. So let's imagine that this heavy neutrino, which has a mass kind of something like this scale M, it's mostly sterile, but it has a little bit of active inside of it. So that means that this amplitude is related to the standard model amplitude for pi end decay by a factor of this mixing angle U. And so the rate for this, you know, depends on how large this mixing is between the electron neutrino or the muon neutrino and then this heavy neutrino here. And in particular, this ratio of this ratio of the branching ratios can be different from one if we have the mixing angle between this sterile neutrino and the electron neutrino or the muon neutrino, and they're not equal to one another, okay? And then also if this sterile neutrino has a non-zero mass. So if those conditions are satisfied, then this ratio is different from one. And so the other interesting thing is that if this sterile neutrino is light enough to be produced in this decay, then, oh crap, okay. So then you also get a, an interesting, you know, signature where the charged lepton is emitted in this decay, but it has kind of, it has less energy. So this is the momentum in the rest frame of the pion. It has less energy available because it has to give some of its energy to the rest mass of this state in the final state. And so that means that in addition to the, you know, the usual bump that you would see from standard decay, you also get a smaller bump where, whose height, relative height between this and this is controlled by the square of this mixing angle. Okay, and so if you do a, you know, bump hunt here, then you can kind of limit sterile neutrinos with a particular mass that have a particular mixing angle. And so Doug and Robert Schrock had a very nice, you know, compendium of a bunch of these studies, or, you know, very similar things. At Pi E nu and elsewhere, and you know, you can see quite good limits on such such things here. So this slide, I don't want to belabor it too much, but it's kind of why you might want to have such a sterile neutrino at this mass scale, and it has to do with dark matter. So this is a paper that I wrote some years ago with a bunch of people. Where we studied this, and actually it turns out, okay, so basically, you know, this is some representation of this dark matter parameter space, and you want to live above this diagonal line because of cosmology, and so you want to you want to live above this line, and then you, these are constraints, these blue lines are constraints from a whole bunch of things, and basically the point here was that looking at pi end decays actually sets kind of the strongest constraints in this parameter space, which is quite nice. But I'm happy to talk about this in more detail later because I have very little time. I did want to mention some more recent work by Bhupal Dev and collaborators, where, you know, they've been looking at a different situation, but kind of manifests in a similar way, which is bosons, new bosons that are coupled to neutrinos. So we're switching gears here. So now, okay, forget about the sterile neutrinos, and let's imagine that there are new bosons that couple to neutrinos. These can be interesting because they such interactions can actually address the Hubble tension, which is a disagreement in kind of the age of the universe. If you look locally at supernovae, and then you compare it to your estimate of the age of the universe using CMB. I won't talk about how this works, but it comes from the fact that neutrino self interactions kind of give you a phase shift in this multipole expansion of CMB anisotropies, which then manifests as a difference in your how old you think the universe is. But the final state here is actually quite similar. So you have, you know, a charged lepton again recoiling against nothing. In this case, it's a three-body decay, so you don't have a bump, but you have kind of a shoulder. And these guys, you know, looked at Pi E nu data and other things and are able to kind of rule out quite a lot of parameter space here. And this is the coupling of the boson to neutrinos. And so actually, I think this is a, you know, pretty interesting way of probing the early universe using pi n decay in a kind of novel way. Yeah.
At which level would one have to probe to contribute to the Hubble tension problem?
So, yeah, what's it? Okay, that's a very good question. And basically, they don't really emphasize this point, but I think it's kind of interesting. But basically, so this is the CMB line here, this diagonal line. And you want to address this Hubble tension, you kind of want to be living along this CMB line, not so far from it. And so so you run into, you know, well, basically, you know, Pi E nu already does a very good job, but there are nice models where you can actually get rid of the BBN constraints entirely, which I'm working on. And if that's the case, then actually, you know, doing kind of an order of magnitude better in this coupling is good. So that would be, so I think it's still quite interesting. Okay, so, all right, I have no time, I think. So let me just move on. Sorry, okay, now it works. Okay, so, pi n decays actually are a nice laboratory to look for other exotic physics. In particular, you know, this X17 that was hinted at some years ago at Atomki decays of excited nuclear states, where they saw E plus E minus pairs in their funny five-arm spectrometer and, you know, could reconstruct a bump. But Maxime and Matthias Hostert recently studied these sorts of theories in the context of pi n decays and actually showed that pi n decays can, you know, very definitively rule out a lot of models that have to that are invoked to explain this excess here. So 17 MeV things that can be produced in nuclear decays are also produced in pi n decays. And the interesting thing here is that the theoretical uncertainty is a lot less than it is on the nuclear side. So, so I think that it's actually kind of a better laboratory to look for these kinds of things. Okay, this is a complicated plot that they made that I won't explain now, but basically the point is that the only thing that's left that could explain the X17 is this axial vector, which my colleague David Morrissey has worked on. I won't advertise some other work that I did with Maxime, where we were mentioning, oh, well, if, you know, let's imagine that Pioneer, you guys had a beam of pi minuses instead. You could actually use that to very efficiently make a whole bunch of new bosons that, as long as they have a mass less than the pion mass, so through pion capture. And again, the theoretical uncertainties on this are way, way less than other ways of producing such bosons. Okay, so I think this is the last thing I wanted to mention. So I won't mention the pion beta decay stuff that I've been thinking about a little bit lately, and just flash some kind of thoughts about this. And I'll instead just show my kind of conclusions here. So basically the point is the standard model, we don't know what's, it's very nice, but it has a lot of problems. One of them is the problem of flavor. So there's three generations. God knows why. I have no idea. I think that that's an interesting one. We should tackle it. Along the way, we can study, you know, new physics at a wide range of scales, from the TeV down to kind of MeV scale. And there's a whole host of things that you can do. So I'm excited for you guys to be thinking about this and going forward. So thank you. Sorry for going over time.
Thanks a lot, David, for this very interesting talk. I'm sorry to cut you short, but since I told the chair they have to give the good example, right? Yes. But we have time for one or two questions, I think. So, Doug?
New physics imply beta decay. Is there any that we can look for?
Yeah, so I think yes. But I'm not at the stage where I'm willing to show numbers yet, but I think yes. So we should talk about this in the near future.
Yes. Very quickly, I mean, what's important, I think, for us is to understand what signatures are implied by all this, because we have our standard signatures.
Yeah, okay.
So that we need to
okay.
Paint ourselves into corners, I think, as we design the experiment. That's really the essence.
Yeah. Okay. So this maybe actually this could help, or this is a good excuse to talk about this slide, even though I didn't really. So okay. So all right. Pi and beta decay, very interesting for VUD, perhaps. Maybe it could shed some light there. There's some reason to think that that's interesting. There are. I think it's hard to if we're thinking about new physics that modifies pi and beta decay per se, it's a bit hard. But there's things that you can do that kind of are similar-ish to pi and beta decay, and I think that might kind of get at your question in the sense that, okay, I can imagine a light pseudoscalar, like an axion, that mixes with the pi zero and then decays to two photons, but it's a lot lighter, so the mixing angle is small. But it's a lot lighter, so the phase space suppression is less. So then the final state is the same, but instead of having two back-to-back photons, you'd have photons that are a little bit more collimated. And so that's something, you know, I think that would be an interesting final state that one could look for that might not be in the typical menu of such things. In addition, I mean, yeah, so this last one I wrote down was a dipole transition. If you have a sterile neutrino that has also a dipole transition with the light neutrinos, which is possible, and I had some back of the envelope estimates that the branching ratio here might not be too small if there's new physics at kind of the TeV scale, and this sort of looks like I don't know, something kind of mu to 3e ish, but then but it's actually a four-body final state, so the sum of their energies isn't always going to be reconstruct, say, a muon or pion or something. So you might instead look for E plus E minus pairs that reconstruct some lighter resonance. So something like that. So I think, you know, I guess I was trying to show, you know, the usual sorts of things that you can look for and maybe in a little bit different parts of parameter space, and then here some more exotic stuff with final states that I think shouldn't be thrown away, at least not right off the bat, without a good reason.
Comment?
Oh, there is a...
Yeah, I saw there's a question on Zoom, so yeah, go ahead.
So a correction, in your discussion of the effect of heavy neutrinos, even if UE4 and UMU4 are the same, because the kinematics is different, it will change the value of
yes,
R E
yeah.
U.
Okay. Yeah. No. That's a very good point. Yeah. You're right.
Thanks, Robert.
Yep.
So I think we have to go to the next session, but David's office is around the corner.
Yes.
And also, Mehdi and Douglas are joining some of the sessions. So yeah, more discussion during coffee breaks and during the week. So thanks a lot again, David. So now we switch to the next session. session where Lawrence was supposed to be the chair, and unfortunately he's at home sick. Is somebody volunteering to chair? Otherwise, I'll just volunteer. Okay, that's it. No volunteer, so I'll chair the session. I believe Lawrence is the first speaker.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, okay. So Lawrence, I'll just say, I guess, or unless you can access the chat, I'll just tell you the 5 minutes prompt. Is that okay for you?
That's fine. And I'm not able to share at the moment.
Oh, Ben, can you make Lawrence a host or enable sharing?
Try your mouse.
Is that better?
No, not turned on.
Okay.
Good. You guys have the main.
Yeah.
You there? Okay. So I'm just going to give a brief run through of things. I'm not going to go into the whole layout again. I did a pretty thorough job of that in the previous meeting. So I apologize to the new people. But just let me. What's going on? Oh, here we go. Let me just remind people of basically the overall scheme and who will be talking about what. So in what I've been putting forward for the last couple of years is kind of having at the heart of the system this CMS-developed command module that has a lot of I/O for it and utilizes the high throughput Samtec Firefly technology for communication. So at Cornell, of course, I'll discuss this in a bit. We've been developing digitizers that I've been dubbing PiWays recently. These would be 12 channel gigasample digitizers that would talk to the command modules for doing energy sums and looking for triggering patterns and whatnot. And then the readout would be over PCI Express, where there are standard modules now for doing that over the Firefly technology. And that would talk to the command module, another command module that does all the triggering as well. I have been talking in the past to the ATAR group about doing something similar for their readout, where there's custom boards, perhaps around the HDSOC chips, potentially talking to another command module that could coalesce and perhaps do triggering pattern, or that could actually just those could also communicate directly to the trigger command modules, since there would be there's a lot of I/O lines available on that. For the tracker, I don't know yet how that will fit into the scheme. It'll depend on what we choose. And so just in terms of some of the other talks, Jenny will actually be giving us an overview of what's going on with the HD socks. And Jack will be talking a little bit about the PCI Express, and in particular, Bell 2 has developed a nice system that a couple of other experiments have also developed for event building and readout with PCI Express that I hope that we can learn a lot from and borrow from. Of course, there's been some other options that have come out recently. There's SAMPIC digitization and readout is another option for the DTAR or ATAR. And as was mentioned at the LISO liquid xenon best, there's potentially the wave dream system. These will require some thinking about how they would fit into the architecture. Certainly if we went with both of these, I think we just need to rethink the whole system completely. And so someone would need to look into that. Quentin will be discussing the SAMPIC digitization, and Toshi will be discussing what needs to happen to upgrade the wave dream to have it handle the rates that we'd expect. Turning to the command module status itself, of course, as I mentioned, this is being developed for the CMS track triggering for the high luminosity LHCb running. Over the summer, there's been a pre-production run that's been done, out of which we'll get one board. The PCBs have all been manufactured, and because the FPGAs are rather dear, they're going very carefully in the testing verification process. So they've have so far populated two of the boards, one with FPGAs and one without FPGAs, and that's just to make sure that the whole powering up sequence and everything. They'll test that without the FPGAs so that they make sure that they don't blow up the FPGAs, and then they'll be testing with the FPGAs themselves. Now, something that we'll be able to benefit from out of this is the command modules themselves are developed to embed into a standardized service module that would plug in with these connectors you see at the top of the command module board here, and those are meant to plug into an ACTA crate, even though they don't actually use any of the ACTA backplane for data movement or anything. It's really just an expensive way of supplying power and cooling at this point. But they needed a simpler board for testing. And so our engineer actually surprised me and said, "Hey, I've designed this for you with you in mind as well." And so this board will give us, let us have digital I/O ports similar to what we use for a lot of the triggering signals that we send out in G-2. It will let us more easily feed in a master clock input and a number of other functions for flexibility. It doesn't have Ethernet input directly on it, but in talking with my engineer, it's very likely that there will be a sort of early versions of the service module that BU has developed that we might be able to just get from them, since they won't use them in the experiment itself. And that would give us Ethernet inputs that could support things like the SAMPIC system. So that's, uh, we I just need to sort of know what we'll need in the end, and I can push on that if needed. In terms of the digitizer status, once this testing is done, then of course they'll be populating another roughly 20 boards, along with the board that that I'm buying from them. In terms of the digitizer status, not too much has changed there. Basically, the prototype work on designing the first boards are on hold until I get enough sufficient additional funding to fund our engineer on it. However, I have scrounged up enough money to actually push on the analog front end mezzanine design. On the digitizers, the plan is to have three four channel mezzanine cards with SMA inputs. Those would be single ended and DC coupled. Again, four channels per mezzanine. And we're aiming for initially nominally a 1 volt, expecting a 1 volt maximum range signal. But we'll probably build in some resistor selectable gain variation on that front end. And I think everyone like Anna and Chloe and the UW group are all on that thread as we get that designed. A lot of my time is actually, rather than being directly on designing the Pi waves and the firmware for that, it's actually been related to a lot of work on the G-2 digitizers and the module that we use for clocking controls in G-2. In particular, there's a self-triggering mode where I now have an initial implementation complete that will make some of the beam testing work easier to implement. And I know Damien, who I see there, is interested in this as well. There's initial firmware that we'll be able to use that does running averages with local pedestal subtraction so that we can do things like having a threshold on channels that contribute to total energy sums in the trigger and apply gain corrections and whatnot in real time. And also we'll want things for triggering on opening angles in the pion beta decay modes. I've also been working, sorry?
2 minutes.
2 minutes. I've also been working on, thanks, on the circular buffering. But this will be an upgrade to the self-triggering that I've done in G-2, but it'll also be how we plan to handle the triggered events in the DDR4 on the Pi waves and on other things that might be of interest when we're trying to do calibration. Just in terms of what I put into the demonstrator proposal, so in the first year, what I'd like to do is complete the four channel design, and I put in funding for two fabrication runs. First, a two board run where we would shake down the design, and then follow on that with a five board run after any revisions that were needed. And that gives us enough modules to play around with to look at a multi-module system when we're developing the command module firmware. And we'll also then, of course, begin the full 12-channel or 3 FPGA design and do the production for that in run two, along with purchasing a couple of additional command modules that will give us a full test of the triggering and readout. Just in terms of our near-term plans, my whole group has been really focused on G-2. But I am hoping basically to shift to a pioneer do dominated workforce in April, and well, that will give us some freedom to push on the actual command module firmware development that we'll be able to use. And these boards, but with the two FPGAs, I think it will be really nice to be able to do things like use one FPGA to mock up having a lot of signals coming into the other FPGA from Pi waves or from the ATAR, so that we can figure out how best to handle things in the firmware. And we'll also be coordinating with Kentucky, of course, on event building in the PCIe readout. We also have an eval board that mounts onto these FC7 cards, and we'll be able to develop using that, we can develop firmware for the configuring and controlling the whole system, and that will be directly transferable to the final system in the end. So that's it for me. If there's questions.
Yes, thanks, Lawrence. Questions? Yeah.
Oops.
We see your screen now.
Sorry.
Questions? Tim online? Yeah, go ahead, Tim.
Yeah. Thank you, Lawrence, for that presentation. I was just wondering about how it sort of dovetails with the schedule for the demonstrator run. I think I'm reading there is you plan to have enough Pi wave channels for the calorimeter readout, and we would be reading out in that demonstrator run across PCI Express. Is that how I see that evolving?
Yeah, that's what I'm hoping to do, is to have a real test of
Yeah. Got it.
chain, at least for the calorimeter.
And then for the well, I think we'll hear this later. I think for the ATAR, it would be probably this 1 gigabit readout, which would be a separate sort of front end. And a problem really becomes kind of the tying the two together is what I'm sort of thinking about. That's going to be a kind of demonstrator specific thing that
That's
will be
right.
different from the real experiment.
That's right.
The immediate questions to Lawrence?
Get well.
Get well, yeah. Sorry that you're not
Thanks.
here. Yeah, and we have time for discussion afterwards, so we can go to the next talk and then discuss at the end once we heard. I forgot who's next, Jenny? Or yeah, okay.
Yeah, thanks, sir.
So I also interrupt you to tell you the 2 minutes. You're sharing, right?
Yeah. Let me just confirm when it's done. Okay. Yeah, hi everyone. A little bit sorry that I can't be there in person. On the other hand, I'm starting to settle in at my new institution. So I'm going to give you a short update on the ATAR readout with the HDSOC. So this is the high bandwidth digitizer system on chip, fabricated by Nano. We're a local startup here in Honolulu. For now, for the first version of the chip, which has 32 channels, our setup consists of several boards. The big one you're seeing here is just a commercial, for example, Xilinx Nexus commercial FPGA kit. Then we have the actual evaluation board with the chip here. And then for feeding in something into the 32 digitizer channels, we have those two, the terrace or balcony boards in addition. So as I said, this is version one of HDSOC with 32 channels. This should nominally be able to reach 2 giga samples per second digitization rate. In practice now we're at 1 gigahertz. And for a buffer length of 1024, we have around 1 microsecond window. So this should give us enough time to obtain both the pion and the decay muon and positron signals. And this has been tested in the lab at UCSC as well as in the test beam. So together with just a pulse generator injection, but also for our nominal baseline front end, so the FAST3 bonded to a sensor are also then used with the pulse generator and using the NALUSCOPE user interface. Here's an example of what this can look like. So this is the FAST2 chip, pulse just digitized with an oscilloscope, and blue one then here being the HD sock, which has slightly lower bandwidth than the oscilloscope. And for readout here, we have nominally the Ethernet as part of the FPGA board, but then the programming and the UART port. So what we're currently working on or have been working on is mainly to understand and fully actually reach the triggering capabilities of this chip. So the idea is that each channel should be possible to trigger, and so then triggering meaning the digitization autonomously and asynchronously, but you can also use a global trigger. So far we've had to use that, or just triggering on one channel and forcing a certain delay. And it's also been limited so far to the 1 giga sample per second. With an updated firmware and software, we might be able to reach the 2 giga samples. For the next version, version 2 of the chip, this should also be more reliable. Mostly what we've encountered is that we're really limited in the trigger rate. So the more channels are enabled, the fewer triggers we can actually get. An order of magnitude that I remember is around just one kilohertz or so for 4 channels. And of course, for a full plane of 32 or at least 16 channels, this is definitely not quite enough. We've only somewhat recently come to the realization that this might also be just limited by the readout of the buffer to the nanoscope, because we've been using the UART port, but not the actual Ethernet, which eventually would be the idea to use. I don't know if Jack has been able to make more progress on this, but he can maybe comment himself. In any case, this board has just been given to us from NALU for testing and development. And currently that's in Kentucky, also for integration, PC readout, and MIDAS. What we've all to do is to actually take HDSOC in combination with FAST3 to SSRL, so the synchrotron beamline at Stanford. Comparing then again digitization with the oscilloscope versus with the HDSOC. There were one or two test beams, and some additional tests were done by Adam and undergrads in the lab at the X-ray station. So for example, we have again here a photo of FAST2 with two different sensors, a single pad HPK LGAD and a strip AC LGAD. And at the beamline, we have 2.1 nanoseconds between each pulse. So you see one example here of an event with just multiple pulses in the entire event. So this we primarily wanted to do to really check the digitization window and then test the repetition rate capability. The issue we encountered was high noise levels. So 20 millivolts and above, where this was more 10 times than what we had expected. And typically seen around in the lab, like 1 or 2 millivolts. Afterwards, we went back to skip and really looked at the noise in a few different configurations. And this was simply a technical error. So for each channel, the pedestals or the baselines are recorded and then applied, but they need to be upon data acquisition, they just need to be reapplied, and this was forgotten. So hence the real HDSOC data from SSRL taken this time was not too useful. There is another beam coming up, however. So what was done in the meantime is we sort of, let's say, simulated the HDSOC digitization output for testing the peak fitting and peak separation resolution studies that Adam and Simone will present later in the ATAR session in more detail. So essentially, we just sparsified the data from the oscilloscope, which is around 10 gigahertz, down to the 1 giga sample per second, which we get from HDSoC by just deleting 9 points and then keeping the 10th and so forth. And then peaks based on the sparser data. So examples can be seen here. So the blue line is the actual waveform. And here, these peaks can actually be further separated by just using a two template function model instead of just a single single template. And on the right, again, you see in most places we have these neat 2.1 nanosecond separations, but there are also overlapping peaks which we would like to be able to distinguish. But again, more on that later, and then also soon enough atoms or quals. As for current and next work, so we continue on the digitization trigger rates, as mentioned before, and asynchronous multi-channel operation, and then also try and get the firmware modified to actually use the Ethernet readout. As for demonstrator, so in our case, 16 planned planes of the ATAR. We are planning to use the HDSoC V2 chip, so this has doubled the number of channels, 64. And Nalo has been producing a board for a different project, but that we can also purchase, where instead of the 2/3/4 boards, there is an HDSoC and an FPGA just on the same board. And this could be obtained for well certain cost. And we would estimate availability in the coming summer. So this is, if you calculate, these are a bit more channels than we would need. But again, if we still can't overcome the limits on the trigger rates, then we'd probably use some sparser channel readout per chip. So for example, only half of these, like 32 instead of 64, and leaving every other channel. Integration into it, and also, as Lawrence was mentioning, integration with the Apollo boards or the global trigger will be some work. And slightly in parallel or later on, then for more thinking towards the actual experiment in the demonstrator, we're not as constrained, is to actually develop firmware and later boards to control multiple HDSOCs through the same FPGA. And finally, something we can start simulating more concretely in the near future is how to actually distribute or how to arrange the strip channels of the ATAR into different HDSOCs. We cannot instrument one plane with a single chip, so they have to be multiple in any case. But is that then every just interdigitated, so every other strip goes to a different HDSOC, or do we have some channels in the center or on the edges? Or as I started thinking about now, do we actually want to stay within the same ATAR plane? Or if we, for example, would like to try and do some real-time reconstruction in the same FPGA to actually connect strips that are aligned or roughly aligned in the Z direction, so in the depth of the ATAR, onto the same HD subgraph. But this will be continued at UCSC with Quentin at UW, Tim and Jack at UKentucky, and I will myself also try and ramp up. So just a few pictures to give you some incentive. And please do advertise if you have good undergraduate students who might consider graduate studies either in physics or in electrical engineering at UH. Thank you.
Thanks, Jenny. You went well on time, so time for question.
The speed of that is, they just be nervous, but then she did say it could be that it's limited by the testing
equipment right now, I think.
Does Jenny
The speed or the readout when we use multiple channels, you were saying?
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Tim has a question.
Yeah, thank you, Jenny. On this slide here, actually, there's a little bit that was new to me. At one point for, say, the demonstrator run, we had talked about multiple HD SoC chips on a board that would connect to the commercial FPGA. I think now in this case, you're thinking multiple FPGAs, each with a single HD SoC board. Is that right?
Yes, Ish. So this would be the first stage, because these are boards that are just, let's say, ready that we can just buy. But yes, of course, later on, that would be the target. But there's also the question on again, how we integrate those with the Apollo or the global trigger board. So if we then end up having, let's say, an FPGA here going to another FPGA, whether that's actually, let's say, needed, or if so, then again, what the ratio is, like how many of these FPGAs could then talk with the command board and so on.
On the triggering, it seems like if we think of the A target and external trigger, that seems kind of relatively straightforward in that the HD SoCs have external trigger inputs on them and they could all get a common trigger. The much more complicated is the other direction. If we somehow wanted the ADAR to create a trigger, but then you've got all these channels going in, all these different chips on all these different boards, that seems a very complicated problem.
Right, exactly. But so that then really depends on what we would be interested to trigger on. So, and if and this might really be a viable or a really interesting option if we actually have a track in Z. Or if we let's say recognize or build one, and then have that as a trigger. But for sure, that would get a bit more complicated.
And no matter what, we're going to need.
Does a digital signal even come out of the HD SoC? I think I asked this question. They don't have enough pins for that. So I mean, the internal trigger. Say okay, you have a channel, you have a heat crossing the discriminator. I thought it never comes out of the HD SoC, just because there are no digital pins.
What do you mean by that? I mean. What else would come out of it?
Saying that the logic,
it only comes out after the ADC does the digitization. That is too slow. That was my understanding. So I think that it's the same as with the PSI domino chip. You can get the output after the digitizer with the digitization speed which you have, but that's impossible to trigger on the. Or check the analog signal and see, okay, is it above threshold? And my worry is that this never comes out.
Yeah, okay, I think I see now what you mean. But that would depend. Yeah, no, I don't think so.
There is a on the board, on the HD SoC board, if I'm remembering rightly, there's a trigger in and a trigger out. Now, I don't know whether that trigger out means a copy of the trigger in or anything like that. I am remembering two connectors there.
Yeah, two connectors, but also C64.
Okay, Lawrence has maybe a comment on this as well.
Well, I just wanted to remind that we will need something coming out of the ATAR or DTAR to provide the T0 for the event. So it's, you know, we will need to solve this issue.
But at what sort of what speed or let's say delay can we afford there? I mean, would that be just the leading edge of the digitized signal as the T0?
Something like that, yeah.
My point was the digital signal is too slow. So to have trigger capabilities, you need 64, ideally, you need 64 digital outs instantaneously. And the question then to Nagel is whether that is implemented.
And Peter, could you imagine just a sum of the 64 coming out for the T0?
Ideally, if you want to have some pattern trigger capability, if you just have a yes, but it depends
Yeah.
what you, right, what you want to do.
Fair enough.
Okay, I see no other questions, so we'll switch to Quentin and Sampit, and then we'll discuss.
It's already on. Just turn on like this.
How do I? I can go left, but not right. Can you go back to? I mean the other one. Okay, hi everyone. Yeah, so after we heard about HDSOC, I'm gonna tell you
Sorry,
a
can
bit
you share the
about.
screen again? Thank you.
Can you also confirm you can hear me well on Zoom?
Yes, we can hear you.
Great. Yes. So I'm gonna try to bring up topic of discussion and thing we've been thinking about for the ATAR digitization problem using another system which is called Sampic, and that's work that I've done with people at IGC Lab in Orsay and at the LPNH lab in Paris. So Dominique and Francesco, I believe, are connected, and Jeanne also contributed to this talk. So I know I can't change slide. Okay. Just briefly, to remind everybody what the ATAR looks like. So this is the detector we have at the center of Pioneer here. It's made of silicon, and it's a very compact device with about 48 layers. There's 48 layers that are all 120 micron thick, and we have 100 strip per layer that covers a 2 by 2 centimeter area. So we have 48 of those 2 by 2 planes, which then result of about 5,000 readout channels. And the physics we are trying to get there is quite diverse in terms of energy scale. So it ranges from the positron that leaves a MIP level deposit to about 100 of MIPs for the Bragg peak of the pion or the muon. And equally important is that the physics we're trying to do really relies on the time correlation between all of those events. So the pion arrives, stops, and then the muon comes, stops, and then the positron is emitted. And the time gap between all of those things is very important for us to understand the physics we do. I really have to learn how to use this pointer better. There we go. So our data is quite sparse. I think from simulation, we know that roughly, even with pile up there, we have about 50 to 100 strips that lead up at each event. Most strips will only collect a single pulse. So it will, you know, like in the case of the PaiU, it will look like this. There is this one strip there that will have the pion, like the ear and the first hit of the positron, but then it will just be a single pulse. Same for the pi mu e, most of them have a single pulse. However, in many cases, there will be two pulses for where the pion stop, because the pion live only 26 nanoseconds. Then after that, there will be a pulse on that where it stops for the muon to that is born. And also, what we know is that because of the geometry of the detector and the fact that when the muon stop, the pion stop, the muon that is emitted has only 4 MeV of kinetic energy. In average, it will move about 0.8 millimeters in the silicon. So with the geometry that we have, we actually have many, many events where the pion, the muon, and the positron all end up on the same strip, which is what I think is the most stringent problem we have to face for the digitization exercise, which is we may have sometime this first blip and then a second blip and finally a third one happening on the same strip. And the time scale between the first one and the second one is in average 26 nanoseconds, the lifetime of the pion, but between the second one and the third one, it can be very long because the muon lives 2 microseconds. So from simulation, we kind of evaluated about 20% of events will have such a strip, a strip with three hits. So that's a lot of it. Also, it's worth noting that we'll have pileup, so we'll have those old muons that will pop up at any point of time. So it's quite likely that we'll also get quite often an extra hit that can happen on that strip over the time we want to look at it. Okay, so here are some examples of pulses that we took with actually SAMPIC. We used this system in our test beam last summer. So here, as you can see, for different LGAT sensors, so here we have a 100 micron one, here it's 150 microns, and there it's taken at 100 volt of reverse bias versus 200 here, and here same 250 versus 600 volt. And you can see, so depending on that, you can get a sense of what the pulse shape look like. So it span over 6 nanoseconds here for this device, but for a thinner device and at higher, sorry, for the same device, but at higher bias voltage, you can see that the spread of the pulse is quite narrow, so about three nanoseconds. So SAMPIC, as you can see there, the sampling rate is very high. It has a capability of going all the way to 10 gigasamples per second. So for doing this type of analysis of the pulses, it's very important for us. It basically acts like as an oscilloscope. Right. So I think this is just a summary of what I said. So the idea is that we've been thinking of with HDSOC of designing a system that can handle at high frequency over a long time window. With SAMPIC, we're going to try to shift this a bit and see how we can do this over multiple short windows. It's also important to think about the price. We have 5,000 channels, so if the price per channel is high, it gets 5,000 times higher. So SAMPIC is a system that was introduced in 2013 by teams at the CEA lab and IGC lab, formerly LAL in Orsay. And it was introduced as what's called a waveform TDC, which allows for self-triggering, time-stamping, and sampling at high frequency of a short piece of waveform. The idea was essentially to do picosecond level timing measurement. So you will, instead of just doing a regular TDC, you will digitize with a lot of samples, a fast rising pulse, and fitting this, you will get a more precise timing. So they achieved few picosecond time resolution, and of course, the possibility to extract other signal from that because you have the pulse, the charge amplitude, and the system improved as a pretty low dead time. Okay. So this is a schematic of what the system looks like. So here, this is a system with 16 channels, and each channel has these electronics in there. So there is one discriminator for self-triggering, and then the registers to store the timestamp, and the system has 64 cells for the analog memory. And all of those timestamps, all of those samples are taken with an ADC that can go all the way to 11 bits. I'm trying to point at you, but it's not. There you go. So the sampling can be done from 1.6 to 10 gigahertz, to 10 giga sample per second. For triggering, you can either have self-triggering where each channel are treated independently, or you can have a central trigger that is multiply, which share can possibly share a common dead time. You have also possibility to do a time over threshold measurement like from the device itself based on the signal on the discriminators. And the digitization is done using those Wilkinson ADCs that can go all the way to 11 bits. And the chip also has an auto-calibration system and an integrated DAX. It's used in many, many experiments. They've built modules of 16, 32, 48, and 64 channels, and also crates. Here, this is a crate that has several boards with 256 channels. It's being constantly considered by the T2K experiment for their upgrade. Totem, which is part of CMS, uses it, and then you can see many institutes are using them for their test beam mostly, including CERN So they produced 5 versions since 2013, and the V6, which is will be released very soon, is intended to be the last one of the system. And what we have for the test beam is a 16-channel version 1, so fairly old, but it already does very well for us in the test beam. So that's what here we've been using it extensively. So Jesse has been working with Sampic a lot last summer to the data taking we did for the test beam, and she will tell about this later today in the 8-hour session. But overall, it was very successful. One of the items that we hope to improve is that we were with the self triggering, we could not adjust the post trigger, so we were not having we have a lot of sample here without taking data before the rise, and using the more version with the post trig, we would be able to shift this and use our 64 sample more cleverly in the data taking. So here on this table, I have all of the list of specs and trying to match them to what Pioneer needs. So from what we discussed, from Jamie's talk, you could see that in terms of sampling frequency for HDSOC, Jenny was talking about from 1 giga sample to 2 giga sample, sampling could go much, much higher than that. The dynamic range is also very good with up to 11 bits, it probably fits our need. Peter did this very nice estimate a few months ago on the dead time that we could allow for the 8R digitization in the case where we don't use it as a trigger, and end up with about 20 microseconds, which if you compare this to the conversion time and the readout time of Sampic is really not a limitation. The only issue is that, as I explained at the beginning, is that, and it's a big issue, our signal can span a very long time window of about 1 microsecond. That's what we're trying to digitize for. We hope to do windows of about 1 microsecond. So this is really the challenge of using Sampic, is to try to do that. And given that it has a small depth, the way we will do it, it will have to re-trigger many times on the same strip. So to do this, the idea will be to use a feature that Sampic has embedded in the system, which is called the sampling mode. So you put essentially two Sampic channels that look at a single 8R strip. And the problem you have is from the table I showed earlier, there is about a 450 nanosecond dead time. So you can't retrigger on a single channel. The ping pong mode solves this by having two channels that work in pair. And we showed that there is absolutely no dead time between those two channels. So two channels can look in pair into the single 8R strip. And once a channel is recording, the other one is the one that is on alert mode to try to pick up the second pulse. So if you do this, the total number of huge sampling channels will be multiplied by 2. So you will have 2 per ITER strip. But of course, as I said at the beginning, we have at least 3. It's a pi mu e event. You get the pion, the muon, and the positron. So here the idea is that we are investigating how SAMPIC could deal with this by extending this ping pong mode that already exists to, instead of doing 2, we'll have 4 channels. And then you will be, have the ability for a single ATAR strip to have 4 SAMPIC channels that will be witnessing this strip and can therefore record up to 4 pulses. So this is a study that was done by Gian and Dominique, where they took a pulse that looked like our what we had from the test beam, and they saw like how to record this 2 nanosecond wide pulse that are sent one after the other with a delay on using SAMPIC. And they showed that if the delay is less than 4.6 nanoseconds, you get the 2 of them on the first window. However, if it's above 4.6 nanoseconds, then you have to switch to the second window. And by doing this, they also studied that they could do this by changing step by step this delay between the 2 pulses and did not observe any dead time between the 2. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm a little easier because how are you triggering in this case? Could you get a pioneer, you get an external trigger that will allow you.
Each is self-triggered.
I'm sorry.
Each stamping channel is self-triggered. So once one starts to trigger, the other one is on alert mode and will pick up the second pulse arrives.
So if you have one that's shut off, one that's disabled, and one that's enabled, when the enabled one triggers, then you enable the other one.
Right. Yes, the other one is able to pick up. Yeah.
Each channel can capture only one pulse.
So each channel will record for 64 nanoseconds, for 64 samples. So if you do at 1 gigahertz, I guess somebody will be 64 nanoseconds.
Go ahead.
Why do you need a 4th channel and why is ping pong mode not enough? Because of pioneer. Do we have like signals that are in between 4.6, like four signals in between 4.6 nanoseconds?
So, right, in Pioneer, let me get to that number actually in one slide. Right, before I go to the question, just what are our plans for the ATAR? What are the next steps we are trying to build? So we have first a requirement for a demonstrator where we have about 500 channels, where we might take pion data, but it's very likely we will only be working with muon data. And then for the V1 requirements of the first device, this is where we have to go to 5,000 channels. So the idea is to, with Pantic, will be to build a system that rely on this ping pong mode. Channels will work in pair or more. And the interesting aspect of this is that when you build a SAMPIC system, the chip itself, the SAMPIC chip, is actually a modest part of the cost. What dominates the cost is the rest of the system. So adding more chip will not just multiply the price per channel. It will be much more, an increase that will be much more modest than that. So to answer your question or to bring it back up, so for the demonstrator, let's say we use a system that exists because building the system with 4 channels will take longer. So we just have this ping pong mode. So we have the ping where we do a first window of recording and then the pong where we do the second one. So if you only have 64 nanoseconds, the probability of the pion decay within that time window is about 90%. So you should be able on that time window in 90% of the case to see the pion and hopefully the muon. With a sampling rate of 1 gigasample per nanosecond per second. And then you will take the positron on the pong. But of course, this is still quite losing some data. If you had a system where you have 4 of them, then you will, for most events, you will only have 3, the pion, the muon, and the positron. And you will have a fourth one that will be a spare if there is a pileup event. Actually, so I can, so that's the thing there, that if you do this, if you have the ability to have ping pong mode with four of them, then assuming that you're only trying to get, you know, you're deciding that you won't get more than four signals, four pulses on a given strip, then you can decide to sample at much higher rate, because you will have just four windows that can happen at that. You have your 1 microsecond timeline, and at any point on the timeline, you can record the pulse on it. That would be the idea of the system. An existing sampling system is 44 kilo euros for 512 channels. So if you were to just build a ping pong mode out of the system that exists right now, not do any modification, you will have to spend twice that money to have two sampling channel per strip. But as I said, the chip itself is a small fraction of the cost. So one could design hopefully a system where you have two chips on the board, on each board, and bring that down. Yeah.
And you were saying there yeah. is no dead time. No problem if you have a pulse in between the two windows. So
right, so that's what Dominique and Jian showed, that there's actually no dead time between the two windows.
Why do you need to extend to four for the ping pong mode when three would be? I mean, obviously, it's good to have an extra. But
yes, it's just big. I mean, Dominique probably answered this question. It's just four is easier than three. It just go 2, 4, and then.
Yeah.
But it's good for us because then we have the extra spare one because there is a pile.
Yeah, you want me to answer? Or?
Yeah, go ahead, Dominique.
Go ahead. Hi, everybody. So, Jian is like next to me also. And so the fact is that 16, you cannot divide it by 3. So, it's the first thing. And the second thing is that having a value of 4 would permit. If an event is shared between different strips, it could permit also interlacing with another event on a neighbor strip, and also to get the heat corresponding heat. So it means that you get the 3 for a given event and 1 from another one. So it gives you margin.
Margin.
Go ahead, Peter.
Maybe we should not go so far. It's totally easy here. My last question. So, why is this ping pong mode at all? Why? I mean, you could look at this thing differently, just saying this is a deeper buffer. Right? You could say if you add 64 times 4, you have.
Yeah, it's exactly equivalent to a multi bank system.
The problem is. If you have a pulse and then you have to trigger in analog on the tail, then you don't know really what you're doing, right? So it's much nicer to trigger always on the leading edge and get the whole thing. That would be my worry, right? You cut into your tail and then this guy has to know, and he will never trigger like another one when the timing is different. So, I mean, it would be just a deeper switch gateway in a way, right? Adding 4 of them.
It's not perfect. The sound is not perfect, so it's hard to follow.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, sometimes when you're at the edge, the mic don't pick up, so. Do you want to repeat the comment from?
I guess Peter is asking how is that different from having a deeper buffer, and I'm not fully sure I understood like your worry, but you're saying that there could be some dead time and just by the retriggering.
It's very tricky at the interface when you may have something that's above threshold, not above, as you switch to the next guy. That's always a tragedy. So I think Peter's saying, is there a way to...
It's implemented inside the chip and it works perfectly. It works already, so.
Yeah. That's his worry anyway.
So that's what you're worried about, is it the transition from the first verse to the second verse?
Right, it happens. Sometimes it happens at 30%, sometimes
right.
at 10%, sometimes at 50%, every time you run and
yes. so
clean analog trigger to make the decision.
Right, so that is what we, that is what Gian and Dominique looked at a few weeks ago, is that they did exactly that exercise. They moved, slowly moved the second verse away, and they didn't see any, you know, like you can see, I mean, the picture of it.
Yes, this test we made just lately, and see here we are using two channels in pair, in ping pong, and either the distance is very close and then they will be on the same, in the same 64 samples, because the pulse length is very short, or there is some delay, and then we see that the other channel takes the continue. It takes over. It will record the second pulse, and it works perfectly already. This is something that is already implemented inside the chip.
I think the issue is that if we want, for example, 5 giga samples, we might not need 5 giga samples. If you have 64, then it's that's like 6 nanoseconds, right? If you go, well, 12 nanoseconds. And if you only have a pulse at the edge of the other pulse, maybe it doesn't cross the trigger anymore, and at that point you're losing the information of
right.
the second pulse. So we just have to
yeah.
fine-tune it so we don't have this kind
yeah,
of issues.
Yeah, I guess we could do a bit more test to understand
yeah.
if there are some blind spots, if like it's a small pulse that comes after.
And we need around 2 giga seconds. But even then, you're down to 32 nanoseconds.
Yeah. So
yeah.
here, for example, we were sampling at 6.4, so the window is 10 nanoseconds, and we can move to the left with the post trigger the pulse. So in so that's within the margin. If the pulse is less than 4 nanoseconds, we see the full pulse shape. Otherwise, we see it on the other channel properly.
Anyway, we will have to tune the sampling frequency in order to have something like 5 samples on the rising
baseline.
Edge
yeah.
on the rising edge of the pulse, and then if from what you have shown up to now, it could be 6.4, but could be better, maybe 5 giga, about around 5 giga.
Yeah.
And then you have a perfect definition of the signal, and also you have a wider window, can go up to 12 or 13 nanoseconds, which is perfectly adequate for the ping pong system. So this has to be tested in real life.
Yeah.
So 2 points. One is, when you're doing this testing that they're doing with the two pulses, you need to create a little bit of a library of the types of things that will happen, where
right.
we, because the energy deposits and so on are going
yes.
to be very different. And as they merge the two physics pulses, they're not distinct things that you know, you're looking at. They become very blurry, it's like they do in the calorimeter. But that was just a comment to this. My question I wanted to pose for a little while now is, does this system, the experts can answer from afar, does the system have the equivalent of, I would have an enable. So the trigger could be, you know, a pion coming in through DTAR, in which, because we have multiple triggers, sometimes we look for a microsecond, sometimes we look for 50 nanoseconds, sometimes we look under different triggers with different prescale factors.
Mm-hmm.
So in some sense, what we really want to do is, on a certain trigger, open up a window of observation and not bias the observation, but record what is observed in the observation window. And so I feel like what we need is not self-triggering as much as
yeah,
enable.
But we have the chip has the trigger enable input, which can do exactly what you are.
Yeah, that's what I figured you were going to say. It has something like that, but that's kind of, I could imagine how we record some of these. We ought to think it later. We'll hear a discussion. Actually, it'll come up in a talk by by Patrick on triggering, and you'll be reminded what the triggers are, everybody, and we can rethink this kind of nice electronics and see how it maps.
It comes back to this question of whether you can think about it as a deeper buffer.
But that's on a different chip, I understood, Peter. That's why they're adding extra chips. It's not on the same.
Hang four other 28 channels together, and then you trigger, and that is the circular buffer, and then you trigger.
Oh, well.
But if there is an enable, it's actually completely.
Then you don't have the trigger bias at all. That was almost Tate's point, because it's an external trigger.
Yeah.
Okay, we are running really over time. So is it finished? Or
yes, I'm done.
The internal presentation?
Yes.
A reminder, we have the Google Doc.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So, post questions. So, you can get to that from the main Indigo page and the Zoom connections and links tab on the left. Then you'll see the bottom link is to the Google Doc there. So, yeah, post any extra questions there.
Yeah, and Dominique and Jean, don't hesitate to look through this Google Doc. Some questions might be directly addressed to you. Okay, so let's go to the next talk.
Very nice. I like this electronic session early in collaboration because it's at the end, I have no bandwidth to pay attention.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like I'm learning something at every talk. No, I mean, sometimes I get kicked.
Okay. So hi, for those of you who know, I'm Jack. I'm a graduate student at the University of Kentucky. And today I'm going to talk about all the recent work we've done on the DAC at Kentucky, which is I've split up into four kind of categories. Four different DACs I'm going to talk about. The first three listed there are all ones that we're working on, and the last one is this Bell 2 experiment DAC that we want to steal some things from that Lawrence mentioned. So for the first DAC, this is the DAC that we use for the test beam at PSI, and we used it at University of Washington right now. I'm just going to talk about some few things that we've updated since the test beam. First, we're using a new operating system, Alma 9, instead of CentOS 7, just because CentOS 7 has reached its end of life, so it's much harder to work with. So this makes things actually a lot easier and more modern. Now we have the ability to use multiple micro TCA crates, so you can have more than 11 digitizers in your experiment. Lawrence talked about some additions he made with the self-triggering mode and the laser studies. As far as the ray capabilities, we've improved those a little bit. We've removed this Meinberg dependency, that's kind of a G-2 artifact, and that lifted this kind of 2 kilohertz limit that the Meinberg imposed for the event rate. And at University of Kentucky, we've tested event rates of around 10 kilohertz. That varies based on your system, though. And then just some user quality of life scripts and updating Midas to a newer build for just easier use. Since the DAC is kind of its complicated mess where some things are from G-2 and some things are now for this Pioneer kind of branch, I've written some documentation for how to build the whole system if someone needs to, how to operate it, especially configuring the ODB and Midas to make it do what you need. I have links to that if you want to go back on the, I guess, DocDB where this will be stored, or the webpage. So some more software that we added. Some of this is new, some of it isn't. If you want to use this DAC, then there's tools for kind of just viewing a
generalized DQM page will just display what's coming out of each channel. I've added some more event level info into the actual MIDAS databanks for diagnosing rate problems as well, if we need to do that. And I've also worked on kind of optimizing this publisher that was running slow during the test beam. And I've created a library in C++ that you can import to speed that up. So I'll hopefully move that along into creating just a more generalized DQM page for when we use this DAC. Okay, so I'm going to move on to this HD SOC that Jenny talked a little bit about. So I've been working on implementing this into a MIDAS front ends using this Python package called NaluDAC that Nalu, the creators of this board, have developed to interface with the board. So we're using a Python MIDAS front ends and just implementing these Python methods in order to get data out of the board and configure in all these things. So far we have the ability to initialize it and kind of configure the external trigger and a little bit the internal trigger and read out these UDP packets, but not we're now at the stage where we're reading out actual constructed events yet. So as far as the data rates go, just reading out these UDP packets without actual event construction, we're at 55 megabytes a second out of 32 channels. So this is higher than Jenny was seeing over the UART because we're using the 1 gigabit Ethernet connection. So that, I don't think this data rate's a concern. There is a strange concern that depending on the island size, your maximum data rate changes, but it's still at this 20 megabyte a second level, which I think is covers our needs. Some things that I'm working on now to kind of fully integrate this in the MIDAS is making sure we can get the pedestal scans, subtractions into that, kind of the initialization of the board. Also configuring these thresholds is kind of not intuitive. So there's a threshold scanner that you can run to get your thresholds and set them. And I guess the most important thing is actually constructing the events from the UDP packets. And through all of this, Marcus Luck is the software head at Nalu, and he's been helping kind of guide us at University of Kentucky into this. Okay, so I'm going to switch to the third deck I'm going to talk about. Jeez. Okay. So this is what I used to call the Pioneer DAC, but I guess it's more just this PCIe-based DAC. At least for the test beam, we're going to use a system like this and some system for the ATAR as well. So it's not the whole experiment DAC. Some developments we've made on this hasn't changed too much since the last time I talked. We're still using this development board, but I've written a library that kind of interfaces with this, the driver that reads out the PCIe data, the data over PCIe. And I'm able to put this library, interface it with MIDAS and then read data out of the board and rate test it that way. So right now it's just kind of reading an empty section of data. It's just reading the same thing over and over again. But we can still rate test the reading rate that way. Jeez. Go back. So the short story is that we're able to get about 1.2 gigabytes a second out of this board that we're using, but that's largely, that number is limited largely by the board itself, which can only has a maximum throughput of about 2 gigabytes a second. With more modern kind of PCIe cards, I imagine this will improve by a large factor, and more modern cards have throughputs closer to 16 or 32 gigabytes a second. But you can see there the read speed for one channel, you can measure to, depending on how big each transfer is, which will be depend on our experiments of how big we want each kind of event payload or set of events payload to be, you improve with your reading rates the more you read out at once. So that's kind of just a configuration parameter we need to think about. The next steps for, I guess, simulating the experiment at Kentucky is we want to interface this new kind of firmware addition I made in Vivado with this MicroBlaze, which allows me to write C++ code and run it natively on the FPGA. This way I can write, I guess, experiment simulators, things that will spit out data onto the RAM to read out onto your host, which would be the desktop in this case. Do other things like maybe edit some registers to control whether or not you want to read out data. Okay, so now I'm going to talk about this Bell 2 PCIe DAC and what we want to take from that, or some things we want to, at least at a first glance. For those of you who don't know about Bell 2, it's an experiment studying beam mesons in Japan. I don't know too much about it, but I did read their DAC paper. In 2020, they recently upgraded their DAC to this PCIe-based system using these PCIe 40 cards that are very similar to the way we want to run the Pioneer experiment for readout. And the card itself is very similar to the NIRIAD board that I just talked about in the previous slides. So I kind of think of this PCIe 40 board is doing two things. One is the readout, which is very similar to what I already discussed in the previous slides. What they've kind of put into this PCIe RAM DMA engine block is very similar to this block diagram that I talked about a few slides ago for reading out data over PCIe. So we've more or less got this part already done at Kentucky, although there's various things like what driver to use and how we want to optimize that can potentially affect the event rate or the rate readout data rate. On the control and event processing side, this is more underdeveloped at Kentucky. We don't really have anything that looks like this yet. So it's more so this left side of this diagram that we want to learn from. This QSys generate endpoint is just some Intel language talk about that says that's just the PCIe part of this transfer. We really want to know how to take data out of a set of links, data coming from all over the place, put them in these buffers, and build some sort of state machine that takes out the data and builds it into events and formats it to be sent over PCIe. And how we want to do that is we can really learn from this Bell 2 experiment. So that's my talk. Are there any questions?
Good, yeah, we have time for a couple of questions.
I just want to say thanks for all these kind of things that you're doing, because you're enabling an enormous amount of work all over the place, and it's really appreciated. It's not so much I could ask you a technical question right now on this thing, but the band, the speed, particularly in my note I wrote down was Jenny's system had me very concerned, but she was reading out like a scope or something.
She's reading out over the UART channel,
yeah,
which is just a different slower
reading. You just said that's a non-issue. Yeah. I think maybe everybody should make sure they've recorded that in their you know, notes of the day, that if that's a non-issue, then that's kind of important. Right.
For the G-2 DAC, so Meinberg is not needed anymore at all, right? Or is this...
I think it might be needed for Lawrence's some mode heated. I know at UW they're using it. I'm not sure if that's out of necessity or out of
It was definitely needed for something because we didn't have it and it caused problems. So something in more
before the update or after the update?
This is pretty recent.
Okay.
Well, the University of Kentucky can run the DAC without his
but I don't know exactly.
All right, so we'll follow up once we get.
But is that for the this laser mode?
Yeah,
though?
Yeah, yeah.
We're kind of running in a different mode right now than.
I think it is specifically for this laser mode.
Yeah,
as needed.
We have two crates going back and forth with multiple lasers right now, doing a sweeping one past the other test.
Very
I don't even want to mind where a card is, to be honest.
Yes.
But that's okay. it came up in this new version that Lawrence had produced.
No, no, it's from a hangover from G-2. I mean, Tim's master front end required some kind of trigger to do the times, some kind of signal to do the time stamping.
Oh yeah.
And he also does checks that the master has seen the same number of triggers as the digitizers have seen. So if you guys have updated the master front end so that it doesn't need all this stuff anymore, then we don't need the Mindbird cards. There's nothing that I do that requires the Mindbird cards.
There is an FC7 triggering mode that instead takes that timing signal out of the FC7, which we've run in Kentucky and not seen problems, but it sounds like there might be problems at UW that we can look into.
Do you plan to try to use HDSoC in higher giga samples?
So you're saying operating like outside the standard 1 gig sample?
Yeah, exactly. They say they could go up to 2. We tried in the past, and it didn't really work out because I don't know why, it was a firmware issue, but they didn't even spend a lot of time on it. So I don't know if you plan to try this as well.
Not in the immediate plans, but
okay.
Something to track. Right now, I'm just kind of focusing on getting all the software kind of methods into MITA so you can kind of interface with other detectors in Venville is my main goal there.
I think one thing we wanted to understand, in addition to what Jack had laid out on the software side, was this internal, external trigger stuff that was kind of important for us.
Okay, and thanks a lot again, Jack. Go to the last talk of the session by Toshiyuki on the wavelengths.
Share the organizational requirement to adopt the wavelengths, but it's not in a well mature state for this topic. So,
sorry, the sound just cut out on Zoom.
Yeah, confirming no sound at the moment.
Okay, can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you again.
Okay, thank you. Okay, so this is a kind of a reminder, and for the MEC2 readout system, so we use this. Sorry.
We've lost audio again.
Sorry, I'm not talking. I have a problem. Okay. So this is the WaveDream board, and we use the DRS4 WaveDream digitizer in 0.8 to 5 gigasampling per second. And this has a 1000 cell analog memory with a resolution of 12 bit. And so in NEC2 system, raw data contains the 1.5 kilobyte per channel and in total 16 megabyte per event. And the trigger rate is kind of 10 hertz, depending on the trigger threshold and the beam rate. And the original data size is 160 megabyte per second. And sampling frequency is used for drift chamber, like 1.2 giga sampling per second and 1.4 giga sampling per second for others, including a liquid xenon. And in total, 731 nanosecond time window for an event. And this is a very schematic. So in total, 35 crates are used for this. And one crate has 256 channels, and in total, 9,000 channels. And each crate contains some 16 WaveDream board. And at the central part, there is a data concentrator board. This means data is collected in this one board. And also a trigger concentrator board is located at the central part. And this also have some information for trigger, including inside the crate. And this is connected to this trigger crate and so on. And this data concentrate board sends this data to a PC. Okay, so there are two bottlenecks in this system. One is the WaveDream board readout, and the other is the data concentrator board, a network speed to from DCB to a DAQ machine. Okay, so one bottleneck is the WaveDream board itself. So there is the inverter domino link chain inside, and there is a capacitor, and the waveforms are stored in this capacitor. And the readout is done by this flash ADC, like 33 megahertz or 220 megahertz. So in total, DRS4, once this trigger is issued, 1,024 samples times 2 divided by 20 megahertz is read out. So this means kind of a 100 microsecond. So this defines the hardware limit of like a 10 kilohertz. And it's a bit difficult to improve from this hardware. So this is one thing. The other thing is the data concentrator board. So this data concentrate board has one board in each crate, and this should contain all the data. And this is currently done, data transfer is through a 1 gigabit line from the WaveDream board to DAQ machine. And so that means per WaveDream board, one event, 32 kilobyte is used. So this is coming from these parameters. And that means 0.5 megabyte per event per crate is used. So this means the current maximum route rate is kind of 200 hertz. But we heard this FPGA can be changed. So 1 gigabit line can be changed to a 10 gigabit line. So this means the, in total 2 kilohertz might be possible by replacing the FPGA on DCB. And this is necessary, and also require designer change in the DCB board and firmware itself. And this board production and the firmware R&D was done by PSI engineer. And I think we believe it's possible to negotiate this kind of R&D with the PSI engineers. Also for Pioneer experiment, if necessary. Okay, so these are two bottlenecks. And the next thing what we should consider is that trigger concentrator board. So this is the in MEG2. So there are background suppression is done by 6 orders of magnitude down to 10 hertz from the megahertz, 10 megahertz. And actually, this FPGA cells are executed at 80 megahertz synchronous with the FRAS ADC data flow. And this is the typical trigger waveform sample. And this region is used for pedestal subtraction. And this is the analog sum of these total channels. And that amplitude is used to set the trigger threshold. And this estimate of the photon energy is done by a linear sum of the pedestal subtracted signal amplitudes of the liquid xenon photosensors. And each sensors will beforehand, this weighted according to their own gain. Calibration was done beforehand. And design of the 7% flash full width at half maximum at the gamma energy is 52.8 MeV. And trigger latency is 700 nanosecond. And this shows the typical waveform of this ADC wave dream board. And this signal enters the DRS and the ADC. And this is a signal. And this overall trigger latency is kind of 700 nanosecond. And the trigger is generated at this point. So this trigger is R&D was done by a PISA group and MEG2 collaborators, and we haven't started this discussion with them yet. So we need further discussion how to proceed with them. Okay, so then we want to go to the pioneer case. So in photosensors, we may use the 1,700 channels, and this corresponds to a 7 GB per second. And in MEG2 case, there are two data reductions for liquid xenon by using this binning and also the compression. And in total, this might be able to be reduced by like a factor 7 and so on, and in total 1.1 GB per second might be possible. And if we consider this Kato high energy threshold, it should be possible. But for a prompt triggers rate, it might be really difficult. So we need to really think about this. And also for if we want to use this data rate, of course we need data storage. So it might be another issue for this. Okay, so I think that's all. And so let me summarize. So we have investigated the limitation of the wave dream board as a backup solution for the pioneer experiment. And the hardware limitations from the data transfer would be 2 kHz from the DCB, and the data storage should be carefully considered. The organizational requirements are not fully defined yet, and further investigations are necessary. Okay, so thank you.
Yeah, it's better if you use a mic.
An initial question, of course, is with the self triggering.
Use a mic closer.
With the self triggering, can you either already in the domino chip or later on just read out islands? I mean, I understand you're transferring all the 700 nanoseconds, and the occupation is very low. So if you could just transfer the islands, could you await a lot of this problem?
So basically, this DRS4 has a ADC after that. But this has some kind of a transparent mode. So independent of this trigger, this is always reading this DRS four waveform, and this is collected in FEGA, and this is sent to a trigger a concentration board. So basically, by using this flash ADC 20 megahertz mode, it's constantly sampled. So this is the schematic of this. So of course, this can be done.
My question was rather that you are bandwidth limited. So do you always read out the 700 nanoseconds, or yeah, are you transferring 20 nanoseconds, 3 or whatever, 5?
This window is always read out after the trigger is issued. So 1,000 analog sampling is read out with the 1.4 gigahertz sampling speed. Once the trigger is issued, all the waveforms should be transferred. But of course, if we be winning, of course, this number of channels can be reduced. But basically, if we don't do any data reduction in this stage, we need to
There's a question online too, Tim.
Yeah, thank you for the presentation. I just wanted to clarify on your slide that had the table of the trigger rates and the data rates. The 300, so I think it's the slide before the summary. The 3.5 gigabytes per second, that was a raw readout rate. And we were in the proposal, I think we had we needed at least a tenfold compression of that for the storage rate. And I think the storage rate upper limit, we sort of in a discussion with PSI, was about 300 megabytes per second that we could.
Okay, so in this case, if we really want to get this 2 kilohertz in total, we still have 1.1 gigabyte per second, so we need to consider this further reduction.
Mm-hmm. I think so. We get realistically to store the data.
Yeah, thank you.
But this assumes 1,700 channels for a liquid xenon calorimeter.
This is the assumption of the 1,700 liquid xenon.
So
only liquid xenon.
So just, would it be possible to use this in combination with a LISO calorimeter? When we get instead of 1,700 channels, we probably want to read 20 channels. Mm. That will cut our data much lower,
yeah,
right?
Six is the average that fire.
You get this one less background channel.
Well, it's less than 10.
Yeah.
Yes. This would cut us maybe a factor 100 down, yeah, or factor 300.
This is just an assumption of this.
Yeah.
But the motivation to do this is because you have this other system that you're interested in, because the Cornell development is has been some years in effort. Are we trying to? Is there some flaw in that?
No, I was just thinking, if for some reason Cornell cannot get it, because you know this one FPGA, I don't know what is missing. By the time we want to get a quick test run, many mainstream boards are already at PSI. Like you know, as a fail-safe thing, not that I want to replace it.
I think on the Cornell side, it's also the limitation is as far as I understood, is again the data size. And so it's not as far as I understood from discussion with Lawrence, this 1,700 channel is not the issue. The issue is how much we can save on disk.
Yeah, that doesn't work either way,
yeah,
you're saying.
Yeah.
That's a matter of the data.
Yes.
Yeah. That's correct. But one thing, I mean, the Cornell system is an integrated concept that includes, you know, right now you saw the architecture that does include the idea of the ATAR and everything else. I mean, so I feel like we should be careful and just tweak knocking that off. If the data, what you just said, if it's the data volume that's the issue, then we should focus our attention on the data volume for the case of the xenon detector. Rather than, yeah, because this doesn't, I mean, it looks a little bit weak already in the throughput here. That, you know, we don't want to start with our hands tied behind our back.
Yeah. We should come together.
Okay. Another question. So thanks for the question. So we have about 20 minutes. I didn't do a very good job, but I would say we should keep the lunch break to 1 hour to allow enough time for the discussion. So if we have quite a lot of buffer in the end of the day, the only worry is that the online speakers for the LISO, if we shift like 10, 20 minutes, they're
talk.
Later
doesn't hurt them because
yeah,
that's
right.
It's the beginning of their
yeah.
day for Chucky.
So if you're fine with that, then I would suggest we reconvene at 2, so 55 minutes from now.
So
okay.
Tricky question for you.
Okay.
Is it safe to leave the laptop here?
I think so.
Where is this lunch?
The lunch is here.
We'll reconvene at 2 o'clock. Or in 55 minutes from now, the Zoom room will stay open.
By the time we have lunch, so let's say 2, it's 55 minutes and then.